Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to this week's episode of Radio Status to Address Life. I am your host, Levon. We got a lot going on today. We are going to discuss the massacre in Wilmington, North Carolina. As the title of the show implies, before Tulsa, there was Wilmington, so we're going to go into that today. We have some returning guests for that conversation. Brother Rodney, I actually prompted this whole thing in discussion, so we have him on. We're Zooming. We're going to do a couple of things that we don't normally do, but we're going to do them today to get it in. And the champs, well, when we go Zoom live, I'll get into a little bit of talk some trash right now, representing my high school. We did a little something over the weekend, so I got to talk about that. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. How you doing? How you doing, brother? I'm sorry, sisters first. How you doing, Sister Rashi? How you doing, brother?
I was like, oh, wow. I'm finally going to see him just, you know, prioritize, maturity over gender. Anyway, I am doing well. I am so glad that we are having a good show.
I believe so.
I'm saying he's more mature than me. That's not
mature.
Like,
I
say maturity is about making connections, having forethought based on the collection of stored data of the past, historical reference.
Okay. Yeah. All right, that's that bullshit.
And being able
to
make informed decisions based on that information that don't make you look uninformed and misbehaved.
Okay. Brother Rodney, how did you take that? Because I didn't take that going that way at all, but, you know.
Well, Brother Lee, I'm used to it, and, you know, I just praise all the high powers, my God, that I've been able to see 60 rotations around the sun. And then an even bigger prayer is that during those 60 rotations, I have learned a little bit more, and hopefully some of that knowledge has turned into wisdom so that I can then pass it down to those who have yet to have that many rotations around the sun.
There you go. I like that. I like that retort. That's how we're doing. So we got Thomas is going to join us as well today. So that's what's up. It's always a pleasure having Brother Barry on during the conversations. I see the doc is already on. Doc, we're going to bring you up soon, but we didn't forget about you. We're not icing you. We're just trying to get you in the field for the show because I wasn't here last time you used to. This is different energy when I'm on. See, I'm a fool. I'm a 100% certified nut. There is problems in my life, and that's how I go. But I use this as an outlet to get them out, to get free. I just want to run north. And this is my North Star. So this is what we do. Look, as we transition into this week and the anniversary of the massacre, you know, one of the things that struck me was I don't know as much as I thought I know, which is good because there's always room to learn. You know, I had no idea about this massacre. I disagree. I don't. That's not true. I heard about it in passing. It's not something that I took time to research, though. That is more true, because I have read about it in a couple of books that I've broken into. And I've heard about it from some friends, so on and so forth. But again, it wasn't anything that I really focused on. And my ignorance ran so deep that I kept saying it was Delaware, not North Carolina. So I was like, because, you know, you say Wilmington to me, the first thing I'm thinking about is Delaware, because it's right across the street. So I'm like, okay, you talking about Wilmington, Delaware? What happened? Like, they did what? And what? So, Roddy was like, no, bro, Carolina. I was like, oh, hey, yeah, you're right. Got you. So I had to get my point of references together. And I was definitely able to clean that up, thankfully. But in addition to that, as we before we go into the topic, you know, we talked about General Powell last time we spoke, because that's when he actually passed. But Rodney, you wanted to speak more on General Powell?
Well, you know, oftentimes when a person is memorialized and there's the funeral services, that's sometimes the last time we talk about that individual. And studies say that within roughly 5 years of someone transitioning to the hereafter, that their name is not invoked any. And I just wanted to take, because his service was yesterday, for at least us to take some time to recognize a great American, a great human, a great husband. Some people's, and I want a great father, a great son, a son of immigrants, really lived the American dream and rose to the highest level of what it is to be an American in government and throughout life. And I was sharing with Lee the other day that for some reason this seemed to hit me harder than most. It's something that I understand, I know. But I told Lee that in my house, we take our shoes off at the door and leave whatever we've treaded through during the day where it belongs, out there. And then when we leave the house, we put the shoes back on and we go. And then that my slot, you know, I have my own shoe slot, right? But I said with greats like, so many in such a short period of time. John Lewis is no longer with us. All my life, John Lewis has been there. 60 rotations around the sun. Before me, John Lewis was there. All of my life up until recently, John Lewis was there. The same thing with Colin Powell. And what I saw, I told him what my vision was that I'm seeing shoes stack up at the door, whether it's the late, great Dr. Dorothy Height, who I had a chance to spend some time with, whether it's, like I said, John Lewis, so many, Elijah Cummings, great civil rights activist, congressman later, and I still see their shoes. The difference is that when I see their shoes, it's like looking at basketball players' shoes. You know, they wear like 14s, 15s, and 16s, stuff like that, right? I see these giant shoes at the door. But when Colin Powell passed, and I remember looking over at my door, it was like, this time instead of shoes, I saw a giant pair of shiny combat boots. And they were at the door. And this time, the door, it just exit one way. And those shoes, those, in this case, those combat boots were left at the door. Hmm. And it just struck me that I said, who's filling these shoes? You know, there were many shoes left at the doors of their lives, and they filled those shoes and probably expanded on them in many areas. And it just hit me. It's like, well, who is that John Lewis? Who is going to fill the combat boots, those giant combat boots left at the door of National Security Advisor, General, Secretary of State, first Black Secretary of State, first Black Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, embodied so many firsts. There cannot be another one like him because there cannot be anyone else to accomplish those firsts. And so I just wanted us to take a moment to remember the greatness and the legacy of Colin Powell. And I said earlier, great husband, and I was going to say great father first, but I wanted to touch on that great husband in a time where most marriages have difficulty making it to 5 years. Colin Powell was married a whole bunch of marriage cycles.
Mm.
And he loved his wife Alma so much. And this is what, this is another thing that struck me, and I thought how much he set the example. He loved his wife so much that when he possibly was at the highest point of his career and was looked at, even in the United States, a man of African roots, and many felt was a Republican, there were people from every stripe who was wanting him to run for president, including myself. And I said, we need another sort of an Eisenhower type right now. And people of Democrats, they felt the same way. But he had such a great love for his wife that when his wife had trepidation about him running for the highest office in the land. Now, some people say it's an excuse for this, it's an excuse for that. I take the man for his word and I take his wife for her word. Is that she was so afraid of this man who had risen to the highest heights of American government and American life. Even in spite of all of that, and this is going to go into what the insurrection of the 1898 insurrection of women in North Carolina, is that she was afraid that he'd be assassinated. A man who commanded hundreds of thousands as the chairman, millions, some regardless of color or race, but whose wife was still fearful that if he ran for that office, though it would be her giving him to the American people, but ultimately it might be him giving his life, and she wasn't willing to let go of him. And he gave up all of that potential opportunity for the love of his life, his wife. I was like, wow, how many could do that today? And how many women, how many wives would be able to look at their husband and say, baby, I know this could be, but because of this, I don't want you to. Can you just not do, can you not serve this one time this way and do it another way? And he chose to listen to his wife, and he set aside really the world for his wife. I just thought that was such a testament of a man, of a husband, a father, a son of immigrants, who exemplified truly the ideas of America, as the topic that we're going into is antithetical to him and those very ideas. What an amazing contrast of thoughts that we're going to have on the show today, and I tried to assemble some folks who could share information, hopefully some knowledge, some wisdom, and then tie it all together, the past, the present, and project into the future. So that's sort of the direction that I wanted to go with the show today. And so I wanted to take the time to invoke the name of Colin in its original pronunciation of the British Colin Powell. He eventually adapted it for us Americans, a son of immigrants, a great American, a great leader in many different areas, national security advisor, a black man, that close. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the greatest, strongest military on the planet, helped prosecute one of the most successful military operations in the first Gulf War, and later statesman. And then every Memorial Day, he honors the troops. And I thought this year I'll watch that show and I won't hear his voice. I won't see him. And then we'll be honoring him this year, one of those who are no longer with us. So that's what I wanted to say about Colin, General Secretary, husband, American, African-American, Colin Powell.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rodney. That was so eloquent. And I just want to let you know that he's going to be spoken of because he is a fence person, meaning you cannot all the way love him and you cannot all the way hate him. He had such a complexity, you understand? It was too much for you not to be mentioning him for many, many years, many, many decades, centuries to come. If nothing else but military strategy, right? Military strategy, but you could not love him all the way because he was a high-ranking man of the military-industrial complex. But you cannot hate him all the way because he did the best he could to put some humanity and morality into that. So thank you, Mr. Rodney.
For those that are joining to be a part of the panel, please understand if you hit the number 1 on your phone, that tells me that you want to speak and you want to say something. For those that are just on the ride to listen, that's fine. For those who want to join in, the call-in number is 818-691-7348. Again, that number is 818-691-7348. Rodney, Rashi, I want to pull up Dr. Cosgrove and get her in. Good morning, Doc. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for coming back. And I missed the other show. Was I traveling? Was that the show when I was coming back from Ghana? I think it was. I missed that show.
I think so.
And,
yeah, that was exactly it. Yeah. We were bringing you back in from the motherland. Oh, and Doc, it is so good to hear your voice again. I do indeed remember all that you transferred to us last time. And I'm so excited. I have my pen and pencil. And all I need you to understand is that some of us are going to be in class when you are talking. So I would like for you to, you know, just be sensitive to that some of us aren't, this is not entertainment. For some of us, this is information or what they call infotainment, right?
Right.
Absolutely. So
no, I have notes just like I do in class.
I watched Wilmington on Fire to be prepared for the conversation for today. So I too though have my pen and pad ready to take some notes and jot it down. I pulled up some websites and all that jazz, and so I'm ready. Doc, so what you got? Because I'm salivating over here. I want to learn.
So this morning, you know, Rodney asked me to speak about the 1898 Wilmington Massacre. And so I went back, you know, and I made sure I looked at all the details and kind of the context of what actually happened in that instance of horrific violence. And unfortunately, we have so many in American history that I do have to go back and look at details to make sure I'm differentiating mm-hmm. one from the other, which is a very sad thing. But when I went back and I looked, and it reminded me that it's a really good example of why it is not correct to teach Reconstruction and the Gilded Age as separate parts of history, and that we have to look at them mm-hmm. both kind of being symbiotic tracks in history to really understand what happened there, what happened in Tulsa, and what's happening today. So to get the larger context, what I want to do is I want to place the Wilmington Massacre not only within the context of Reconstruction and the end of the horrible end and failure of Reconstruction, but also of the Gilded Age, kind of the bastardization of capitalism that happened, the degradation of capitalism that happened during the Gilded Age, to kind of explain why no one was held accountable for what happened and why we're seeing so many signs of the same embedded problems coming back again because we haven't really dealt with them. And so if it's okay, I'm going to go ahead and provide a little bit of context before we actually talk about what happened in Wilmington. Is that all right?
Yes, ma'am. It's your floor. Absolutely.
Okay. So after the Civil War, there was a group of Republicans in the Congress. They called themselves the Radical Republicans. And they were the ones that had actually really pushed Abraham Lincoln into going to war with the South.
One second. You said there were Radical Republicans in Congress?
Yes.
So you're talking about McConnell and then?
No. I'm talking about 1860.
Oh.
1850s, 1860s.
I'm sorry. History just has a problem repeating itself, but I'm sorry.
It does. And unfortunately, when you live in a country that only allows for two political parties, ideologies switch back and forth between the two parties. So during this time period, it was the Republicans who were very much interested in advancing civil rights and ending slavery and the abolitionist movement. And it was actually the Southern Democrats who were the ones that were part of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the group that had very much pushed Abraham Lincoln into actually going to war with the South as a way to abolish slavery, even though Lincoln would not say that that's what he was doing at the very beginning, called themselves the Radical Republicans. So they were the very strong abolitionist Republicans in Congress. And after the war, they were very strong in pushing Abraham Lincoln to treat the Confederates very harshly, to set a punishment precedent, committed treason, that it would not be tolerated and you would be punished. Lincoln, who was a moderate and not as radical, feared that if he punished people too harshly at the very beginning, that the country would remain deeply divided. And after having about 700,000 people killed and maimed in a war, he was trying to figure out kind of a way to slow walk us into a reconstructed nation that would not have slavery and would have equity under the law. And so Lincoln and the Radical Republicans were kind of going back and forth about who had control over Reconstruction. Was it the president or was it going to be Congress? Because the Constitution really didn't say. And so Lincoln, in a way to kind of appease the Radical Republicans, did put urgency behind adding the 13th Amendment to the Constitution before the war actually ended. They could see the war was coming to a halt. General Grant was using a total war strategy, and they could see it was coming to an end. And they needed to make sure that the Constitution had slavery amended out of it. So they knew they were going to have to add a constitutional amendment. They knew that the Supreme Court had to be told through a constitutional amendment that the Dred Scott ruling was not going to stand. And so Lincoln did put all his effort, as much as he could, behind getting that amendment into the Constitution to abolish slavery constitutionally. So that happened, and the war came to an end. And unfortunately, we don't know what would have been the resolution between Abraham Lincoln and the Radical Republicans, because Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. Before they could actually start implementing a Reconstruction plan, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. And this is probably one of the ever happened in American history, not just because Abraham Lincoln was someone that could have healed the country, but because his vice president, Andrew Johnson, was probably the worst person to put in charge of Reconstruction. In 1864, when Lincoln was up for reelection, he was very afraid that he was going to lose to George McClellan, who was one of the generals in his army. And so Lincoln and his party made a political decision to bring Andrew Johnson onto the ticket. And Andrew Johnson came from one of the border states, a slave state, Tennessee, because they wanted to keep slave owners who were loyal to the Union, they wanted to keep them in the Union. So they figured, okay, we put Andrew Johnson on the ticket, we draw in their votes, he's just the vice president, you know, what harm? It was tremendous harm after Lincoln was assassinated, because Andrew Johnson favored allowing the former Confederate leaders back into the Union with almost no punishment at all. And he did not, was not in favor, did not agree with federal protections of newly emancipated slaves. So obviously he had conflict with the Radical Republicans. And so the Radical Republicans tried to seize Reconstruction away from him, and he kept vetoing everything that they tried to do. And we know that he was a president that almost was impeached. I mean, it was just two votes away in the Senate, and he would have been impeached for his obstruction of Reconstruction. And this is why, when you look at the 14th Amendment, this is one of the reasons we have the 14th Amendment, is one of the ways that you can nullify what the president's doing or the Supreme Court is doing is you actually amend the governing document of the nation. And so the Radical Republicans and their allies did that with the 14th Amendment and specifically put in their birthright citizenship and the Equal Protection Clause, that the federal government would be responsible for providing equal protection of the laws. And then if you read that amendment, and the reason it is so long is the Radical Republicans actually wrote their Reconstruction plan into that amendment so that when it was added to the Constitution, there would be no way for Andrew Johnson to veto it again. So it's still sitting there. It was never actually fully implemented, but it's still sitting there in our Constitution. Within that plan, the Radical Republicans had two main goals. First, level the playing field to allow emancipated slaves to benefit from the wealth generated by their own ingenuity and labor. And second, empower black men, black women and white women obviously were not included in either the 14th or 15th Amendments when it came to voting rights. But they extended voting rights to black men, got rid of the three-fifths clause, so they could participate in the political system to protect their civil rights and their property rights. So the Radical Republicans' Reconstruction Plan was empowering the emancipated slave population. They knew that this group was hard workers. They knew they could generate wealth. They just needed to be empowered to be able to work and benefit from their own labor and to then advocate politically for their own civil rights. Obviously, we know what the South did in response. It responded with escalating forms of violence because they understood what the Radical Republicans were trying to do. And so it's important to understand that the threat that the South perceived was not just a political threat. It was an economic threat as well, that all of a sudden a huge portion of your population was being empowered to generate wealth and keep it for themselves. And so that wealth was going to be taken away from the planter class. And so to them, this was not just a political threat. This was an economic threat. And it was almost the economic threat that they were most afraid of as opposed to the political threat. And so they responded with all kinds of violence. This is when you're going to get the KKK, but many other splinter groups that were very violent towards emancipated slaves to make sure they could not be empowered to participate politically or to benefit from their own generated wealth. And so it's important to understand that to also – go ahead.
I'm sorry, Doc, but speaking to that, as far as the folks who perpetrated the violence, as far as the KKK – I'm sure we'll hit on the red shirts a little later. As they were not necessarily those of the planter class. These were poor white folk who were duped into the dirty work of the affluential white folk, because they were told that, you know, it was another assault that they were worried about. I so believe. I hold that it was the assault or the perceived assault on the women. So, you know, I'm looking at and thinking about aristocratic class, and I'm not seeing them necessarily out here riding a horse trying to burn down somebody's home. I see them sending Billy Bob out.
Right.
Billy Bob, you need to get out there. You need to protect your family. And, you know, Billy Bob, yes, sir. And they in turn did the same thing. Did the dirty work to not really benefit from it. You know, and as, again, history tends to repeat itself. I think about that when I think about the Republican states now, the Republican-controlled states. Many of those Republican-controlled states are in the Deep South, and many of them are very, very poor. Very, very poor. Yet they remain on the wheel of the Republican Party to their own demise. I don't get it. Now, in the context of where we're going right now, I apologize. I just want to throw that in there because I want to understand. I hope that we get into a little bit at least of the thought process of these folks, these common folks who helped these rich folks perpetuate this atrocity. You know, because the rich folks were small. They were not large enough as a body to pull off this coup. They needed other people, and I don't understand. I want to understand and or explore what motivated these other people to join them.
Correct, and that, and you're anticipating where I'm going with this, because
right.
Because what
before,
was said,
Professor Cosgrove, if you could give before you go there. We need to take a brief station ID, so hold that thought. I see you're raring to go. And to everyone who is listening out there, thank you for joining another episode of Radio Established to Address Life. We like to call it Real Radio. This morning we're talking about the insurrection, the 1898 insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina. Of course, you have the hostess with the mostest, Brother Lee, chopping it up with our guest, Dr. Sandra Cosgrove, professor from College of Nevada. History is her focus, and she is going to deliver some history that I would bet most of you did not receive in school. So get yourself some coffee. Get yourself some water or whatever your beverage of choice is and pull up a chair because I guarantee you, you are going to learn something today. And so Real Radio, Radio Established to Address Life comes to you every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. on the East Coast. That would be 8 a.m. for those of us on the left coast, otherwise known as the West Coast. And not only do we have Professor Cosgrove from the College of Nevada on with us today, but we also have someone who is a student of Sam Smith, a charter member of The Gathering, and who is also quite knowledgeable in all areas of blackness. Alex is also, as I said, a charter member of The Gathering. And usually before I get into the room, Alex, when it comes to the knowledge of African and African-American history and culture, usually Alex is the blackest person in the room. And I invited him to be on the show today. And we're going to bring him, we're going to bring him in on a minute. So Dr. Cosgrove, I know you were in the groove, so to speak. We'll bring you back on to finish your respond to Lee, and then we will bring Alex in so that he can share his thoughts on the topic. And after that, for the most part, I'm hoping the two of you, until our third guest, who should be in at the top of the hour, will come in and chop it up with us. So, Dr. Cosgrove, if you could finish your thought, and then we'll bring in Alex.
Sure. So, a lot of people, like it's just been said, a lot of people are aware of the violence that happened which obviously was racial violence. But it's important to understand that when you have this escalating violence in the South, the radical Republicans are retiring, they're dying, they're not in politics anymore, and the Republican Party is taken over by the robber barons of the Gilded Age. And so they're replaced by people who see capitalism as very predatory and very aggressive and not something that allows people to move from the bottom up. And so the robber barons do not see a contradiction between free market capitalism and discriminatory treatment of immigrants or emancipated slaves. The radical Republicans did. They said you can't have real capitalism if you're discriminating against people. They're replaced.
Mm.
So that by the election of 1876, Southern Democrats are able to enter into a compromise with the predatory business class that had taken over the Republican Party, and they exchanged a presidential election for the complete end to all federal presence in the Deep South. Reconstruction ended. And so the robber barons and the unreconstructed Southern Democrats basically make a pact that they're going to agree that white supremacy and capitalism can coexist together. And that pact is still very, very strong today. Many Americans disagreed with this conclusion and this agreement to end Reconstruction. But when you've got this robber baron capitalist class really taking over the Republican Party and really taking over the economy, it was hard for people in the North even to push back against them. And this is when you're going to see the Knights of Labor Union is going to emerge, especially in New York City and some of the bigger cities in the North. And what distinguishes them from every other labor union up until then is that it was open to diverse members, that black men and women could join the Knights of Labor. And so you're starting to see in the labor movement how they're trying to push back against this, that you can't have this predatory force of capitalism present in the country that's denying people their economic rights and their civil rights. So they allowed immigrants, native-born, a whole range of ethnic groups. And the reason that we don't have the Knights of Labor here today is because they were crushed for doing that. By bringing white people and black people and people from different ethnicities and religions together as a singular force to fight against this alliance that had happened between the robber barons and the Southern Democrats, the robber baron class uses the federal government to just crush them. And so they get crushed, and then we see the People's Party pop up in the Midwest. Same type of mentality, trying to fight against this alliance by bringing in labor unions, by bringing in miners in the West, by bringing in farmers. But they went into the South, and they organized and made alliances with the Black Grange. And so they made alliances with black farmers in the South to say, we're going to pull you in because we all have to be united to fight against this. And so from the 1880s and 1890s, there was a very strong push from the people who were controlling the federal government to stop any type of movement where you saw alliances between black people and white people, especially black people and workers. And so in the context of the People's Party, you're going to have a place like Wilmington, North Carolina, which had been a black majority city for a long time, but you start to see white political leaders and black political leaders coming together, biracial government, organizing the economy so everybody benefited from their wealth, showing that what the radical Republicans had said could work and it was true, and the white supremacists could not allow that to go forward. They could not allow that to become an example. And so not only do they come in and commit political violence by orchestrating a coup over the government, but they destroy all the wealth. They destroy property. They destroy black wealth and say, you're not going to benefit from the wealth that you've generated. And then the people controlling the federal government, that robber baron predator business class, basically blessed it and said, absolutely, we agree with what you just did. We are not going to stop you. And so from that point forward, not only do you have violence that's trying to keep people from participating politically, but violence that's keeping people in a caste system. And this goes to where what was just said about poor white people and not quite understanding what they're doing. If you assume that they see American society as a caste system where you are kind of stuck where you're at, they definitely don't want people who they see below them moving up into their caste. They see themselves as having a little bit more privilege, a little bit more political power, a little bit more access to wealth and they do not want anybody else moving up into their caste, and so they want to keep people below them down and in that lower caste. And so even though they're not being able to move up into a higher caste, they don't want that caste system to be disrupted by people who they perceive as being below them when it comes to political and economic power. And unfortunately, we still see that happening today, because what did the media say when they were trying to figure out why poor white people voted for Donald Trump? Immediately what we heard is, oh, it's economic anxiety. Well, you can translate that into this type of caste thinking that you have to stop people from below you from getting access to the little bit of wealth and the little bit of privilege that you have politically. And so you see that in Wilmington, and you're going to see that all the way to the insurrection that we saw on January 6th, that we can't have a political system that's going to empower people to be able to move up, to be able to benefit from their own wealth. That system can't exist. And then we're also seeing kind of a political structure that's trying to say, well, no, that's what we do in this country. It's okay what they just did.
So, Dr. Cosgrove, I like the way you tied that into, again, the past and the present. And what many folks may not have realized is up until the 1-6 insurrection, and even since the 1-6 insurrection, because the 1-6 insurrection technically was not successful, but the only successful coup d'etat that I'm aware of in the United States of America, and possibly the first successful coup d'etat, was the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898. And we, so if my little bit of history knowledge is correct, that would be the only successful coup d'etat in the history of this country. And I'm using the phrase coup d'etat in the literal sense, chopping off of the head, because in Wilmington, North Carolina, the head of government was the mayor with the what they call aldermen, what we know as city council, who were dismissed. And I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but a coup happened in the United States of America in one of its first states, North Carolina, in 1898. And the city in North Carolina was Wilmington, which at the time was the largest city in North Carolina. And on that note, I want to bring in another one of our panelists. I mentioned him earlier. Alex Chirp is going to join us. He is someone that I've known for a number of years, ever since he was a much younger man. As a matter of fact, before he got his degree from Northeastern University, attended the School of Law and the Civil Rights and a Restorative Justice, worked on the Restorative Justice Project. And he was told by an elder, Sam Smith, that he should go to law school. And so that's what he did, and has gained a wealth of experience related to Black history and how laws were used to really hold Black people back. So I want to bring Alex on, a student of Sam Smith, member of the gathering. Alex, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Rodney, for that very moving introduction. I appreciate that, and it's always a pleasure to be involved in these discussions. I know for a period of time when we first entered into lockdown, we were doing the virtual gathering for a consistent period of time, and were able to discuss some of these important topics and look at history and the law and think about ways in which we can restore justice, where we can find truth and reconciliation and have some remedies under the law, perhaps less standard remedies, but still remedies nonetheless. And that's the work of individuals looking at truth and reconciliation from a restorative justice lens. And that is ultimately one of the ways in which we can think about some of these atrocities from the past, is how do we reconcile with that history? How do we find justice, and how do we address these longstanding representations of white supremacy? Because as Ms. Cosgrove has pointed out so effectively, this is ongoing. It exists today, and there's these ongoing themes of white supremacy that exist from before the founding of this country until today. And the 1898, November 10th, Wilmington is an important place to look. And you mentioned my mentor, Sam Smith, and I first became aware of the Wilmington, the coup in Wilmington from Sam Smith, and that was part of our discussion that motivated me to pick Northeastern University School of Law to go to law school there and to participate in the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project, which is one of the areas of focus under this current context of restorative justice to look at ways of finding these remedies. And the seminal report on the Wilmington insurrection from the restorative justice angle is the 1898 Wilmington Race Riot Commission that was developed in year 2000 that did try to put together this record that was long covered up about what happened in Wilmington in 1898. But I think Ms. Cosgrove was really in going in the direction that to lead up to this conversation. So I'm ready to participate and weigh in as she continues, and we can tie this in with the law. One of the parts of the earlier conversation that was important was that discussion about the Dred Scott case, right? And then how that under the law, the 14th Amendment, and then the subsequent portions of Reconstruction that had happened in the decade or so afterward, that we had a period of time where there was that hopeful effort to find the items listed in the Constitution and apply them to all. But that was short-lived. And by 1898, we're 2 years after the decision, Plessy v. Ferguson, which was the nadir when it comes to racial relations post-Civil War. And that's part of what is happening as this is coming together. I think by the year 1900, there were no longer any black congressional representatives in Congress, and that extended for decades and decades and decades for the most of the 20th century. So we see, as Ms. Cosgrove was saying, the loss of that political power, but also this trend away from any type of reconciliation, of any type of truth, of any type of rebirth of the Constitution through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and instead a continual steps in the wrong direction, the creation of Jim Crow laws, the Plessy v. Ferguson ruling, the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, which we see when we're talking about January 6th, this new memo from Professor Eastman talking about using the election of Rutherford B. Hayes as a blueprint for this attempt to overthrow a democratic election in this year and last year is a representation of how we had a very limited window where there was going to hopefully be some type of reconciliation, and that began to disintegrate more and more, and ultimately ended up with some of the most the biggest atrocities, including this coup. So that's kind of the way that I'm hoping that that we are continually to not only talk about the history but actively pursue justice. We're seeing that with Greenwood and what discussions we had following the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa massacre, what is next and what can we do? Because the amount of injustice the presence of white supremacy in the history of this country, embedded in the structures in this country, we need to find a way to bring justice. And I think that this discussion about the Wilmington insurrection is important there too, and finding ways in which we can have that resolution.
Well, Dr. Cosgrove, I've been waiting for the moment that I could sit back and sip my beverage and just listen to folks like you and Alex chop it up on important topics like this. We're going to do another station ID in about 9 minutes. So between now and then, just pretend that you're in your living room or whatever your kitchen table, whatever your favorite room is. And as we continue the discussion of the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina, the 1898 insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina, that was listed in the newspapers as a race riot, not as an insurrection, not as a coup, but as a race riot with the Negroes of the day. They didn't call them Negroes. It was another word with an N. But the Negroes of the day who perpetrated this riot. And as the two of you chop it up, can you go into the feelings of some of these people and who some of these people were? If you don't have the specifics, even some of the generalities of who some of these people were. And as you go back and forth between the two of you, relate how some of the things that are being said and some of the people of then, how they relate to some of the things being said and some of the people of today. Professor Cosgrove?
So when it comes to relating to what's happening today with what happened then, it's easy for us right now to look at voter suppression laws and to look at things that are happening politically to take political power away from people of color. But it's just as important to look at what's happening with the two bills that are trying to go through Congress, the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better bill, where there's a lot of support for that infrastructure bill, because that's a traditional way of kind of allocating money out to the trade unions, which, as a historian, have had a bad history is when it comes to racism, that they're oftentimes controlled by older white men, and they get to decide how that wealth is distributed. But the Build Back Better, notice that people in Congress that really support that are people of color, because that bill empowers people to be able to generate their own wealth and to keep their own wealth without anybody controlling them. It gives them power. That's the bill. A Joe Manchin from West Virginia, he has a lot of problems with that bill for the reasons that we're talking about today, that you don't want to empower people politically, but you also do not want to empower people economically so that they can move beyond the caste that we keep them in for our economic purposes.
It's deeper than that, Alex. Hold on 1 second. It's deeper for that for me, for Joe Manchin. Here's the other side. For me, as a political party, the Dems have a problem of eating their own. The Republicans do not. The Republicans understand that in order for their agenda to move forward, sometimes somebody has to go. And they are willing to take those losses in order to get the gains that they understand they need and want. Joe Manchin has been in Congress God knows how long. It's been too long. Sir, it's time to go. If a Republican comes and takes your seat, who cares? Get what's better for the country passed off the table and move on. Live your life. Enjoy the rest of your remaining years. It's over for you. If a Republican comes in and wins the next election, then what's that, 2024, 2028, 2012, 4 to 8 years, that person will get kicked out. Reason why. What's happening is there's a large migration of folks, federal workers, that are moving from Virginia and Maryland to West Virginia. Why? Because it's cheaper. They are finding it cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to move to West Virginia. So you get this infrastructure bill passed. There's a lot of money in there for Amtrak. What does that do? That gives you better routes from West Virginia going back and forth to Washington, D.C. for work. What does that do? That makes it more available and open and appeasing to those folks who are more liberal, who are and or moderate to move from Maryland, Virginia, Northern Virginia specifically, and D.C. to West Virginia. It makes it even more appealing. Understand the long-term game. You're being greedy. You're being selfish. Let it go and move on. It is a dummy move. I don't understand what he's trying to get. You know, I don't see the game that he's trying to get. I don't get it. It really is a dummy move on his part. It would be better not only for his party, but the people of America to move this agenda forward, because these are the things that we kicked down the can a gazillion times. And finally, we have a president in position that says, okay, you know what? I'm not going to kick the can anymore. I'm going to put myself out there. Let's move this. And again, we're looking to kick the dang can. Stupid. Just a dumb move. Dummy move. I'm done.
Well, I'm glad you got that off your chest, brother. Alex, Professor Cosgrove, you know, these things don't happen overnight. Just like 1-6 didn't happen overnight. Can you maybe go into a little background of the temperature of the climate and some of the things, and I know you touched on it a little earlier, some of the things that led people to feel the way that they did and to act as they did, and also kind of relate that to the present. And you have 4 minutes before we do another station ID.
Go ahead, Alex.
Well, yes, Dr. Crossgrove is spot on with the analysis. And I think there's a presence of just anti-democracy from the founding of this country that remains to the present day. And that this is a representation of a form of power and control, a representation of a form of fascism when it comes to thinking about the political structure. If you think about how long it took for individuals in this country to not only have the right to vote, but in reality vote. See, some folks were granted the right to vote. We were talking about the 15th Amendment. Some folks were not even to vote, were still prohibited from voting. And even if the right to vote was identified, that there still were incredible restrictions that made it impossible for individuals to vote. We see this focus on anti-democratic tendencies in the history of this country. It's linked directly to slavery. It's linked directly to what Dr. Crossgrove talked about earlier today when the concept of birthright citizenship was discussed related to the 14th Amendment. So I see what's going on today as not only a representation of the ideas of the Confederacy and of those white supremacist concepts that come from that part of history, but also the longstanding history that certain, as we're talking about caste, that Dr. Crossgrove so appropriately pointed out, that certain individuals should not have access to government, should not have access to controlling the decisions of this country. And that is embedded in the history of this country when it comes to black folks, when it comes to indigenous folks, when it comes to women and so many others who were prohibited from having involvement in the electoral process. And this is a representation, a direct representation of that lineage because of the fact that the number of voters of color who elected the current president were responsible for the win and the defeat of the previous president, that this is a representation of that pushback against having the ability to be engaged in that power. And being able to participate in the electoral process. And if you look at where the election results are being contested, for instance, in Georgia, you had in Wayne County, Michigan, there was that discussion about, oh, well, we're only going to contest these areas. There is voter fraud happening in these areas. When we look at, for instance, Wayne County, Michigan, and those are the areas that are predominantly black areas. And the X-45, the previous president, and his efforts to suppress the votes, to overturn the results from that election for President Biden, demonstrates that resistance to allow the access to the vote. And when we see that there's a win for President Biden, that it's saying, well, no, the supporters think, well, of Trump are saying, well, we had more votes, right? Well, they're looking at it more white votes, right? That those are the votes that count, that those are the individuals that should be engaged in that political process. And there's a direct tie-in to Wilmington, because the insurrection didn't just happen overnight. The insurrection was not only the Dr. Crossgrove talked about the history, but in the local state government, in the surrounding communities, there were efforts to find ways to interfere with the progressiveness of Wilmington and interfere with the fusion party and the Republican power that was in, and this, of course, is the Republicans of then, that were in power. You had blacks in leadership. You had a population that was over 50% African American. You had, I believe, if I remember correctly, 10 police officers who were black. I believe the treasurer was black. I believe that other individuals in elected office in Wilmington were a representation of this fusion effort of moving away from the structure of white supremacy and creating an integrated government with leadership from black and white individuals focused on racial reconciliation and equality and anti-discrimination. And so when this was being viewed, this was a threat. And the efforts leading up to Wilmington were through participation in the development of, I believe we heard about the red shirts before, which is a representation of white supremacists, KKK, and so forth. And also through concerted efforts to work to defeat this power and structure that existed in those progressive communities. And through a collected campaign, these efforts were starting way earlier in 1898 and before, particularly looking at these what was going to be happening in the election of 1898. A good example of that is what happened in 1898 in Phoenix, South Carolina, in another Greenwood, South Carolina, on November 8th of 1898. And that was 2 days prior to the insurrection, where there was another effort of the white supremacist, white power movement connected directly to Wilmington, I would say, that was working to prohibit a fair and balanced election there. Now, the difference was in Phoenix, South Carolina, you had control from the segregationist party. You had control from the party of white supremacy, the Democrats at the time. But there was an effort of a Republican candidate at that time who was trying to get others registered to vote, to get black folks registered to vote and participate in the electoral process. And this was interfered with by the Klan, by the white supremacists. The individual there was a fight. The individual who was trying to register those individuals to vote was beat up. And then it ensued another smaller massacre ensued, and eight black individuals had died. And then 2 days later, it was in Wilmington that the insurrection occurred. So this was something that was in the public consciousness at that time, and important to think about as we go to that history. I think we're ready for station identification, right, Rodney?
Yes, we are. Thank you, Alex. And you've been listening to Alex Chirp, law graduate of Northeastern University. We also have as a guest on our show today, Dr. Sandra Cosgrove, professor of history at the College of Nevada, also a graduate of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Hopefully I got that correct. And everybody, you're listening to Radio Established to Address Life, otherwise known as Real Radio. Your hosts are Brother Lee, Sister Rossi, and of course yours truly, Rodney, sitting in the air chair. What we're talking about is the insurrection of Wilmington, the 1898 of the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898. And we're trying to share what happened then, how it happened, and related to some of the things that's going on today in current event. Professor Cosgrove, please give a response to Alex. But as you both move forward, I would like for you to touch on what it meant to hear Negro rule, the phrase Negro rule and white supremacy. So Negro rule is a topic that I would like for both of you to hit, and how that influenced this insurrection and the people's temperature, I'll put it that way, because there's a movie out called Wilmington on Fire. So Dr. Cosgrove, if you could pick up, please.
Thank you. I think it is important to understand the reaction to Negro rule, but then also understand the very violent reaction, and Alex touched on this a little bit, to black and white people working together. And in Wilmington, you really see that this was a strike against anything biracial, that this was not going to be allowed to happen. Same thing happened with the Knights of Labor. Same thing happened with the People's Party. Every time you started to see these coalitions build of white people who had traditionally, as Brother Lee had said, had been used by the planter class, had been used by the robber barons to attack people in other groups. When they say, well, wait a minute, I actually have more in common with them, I'm going to go work with them, they're punished. That gets shut down. And it's white supremacy is irrational, and it hurts white people too. If you listen to Reverend Dr. Barber right now today, he preaches about this all the time with his Four Peoples campaign. And he touches on this, that white people and black people and brown people all have to work together because we have something that we can all achieve when we work together. But there is often very violent reactions to that type of coalition building by the people at the top who are used to using kind of white people who are lower middle class, working class, as their strike force, as the people who go out and attack Negro rule, who go out and attack, you know, anybody getting out of their place. And so in Wilmington, North Carolina, that definitely was something that happened, is it was a strike against this coalition building that was going on, and it had to be stopped.
So, and Alex, if you can touch on, was Negro rule a real thing, or was Negro rule something that was made up and became a bastardized term that invoked people to have negative feelings about shared government? And how was this flexion of blacks and whites in office together sort of where America could have gone?
Yes, it was white supremacist propaganda. And the idea behind Negro rule is similar to the idea behind the campaign that was happening at the time about the threat of black men toward white women, which is an essential component to the Wilmington insurrection story, namely that the purity of white women is being threatened by the black man. And there was an editorial I see in our description of today's event that we have a hashtag for Alex Manley, who was a newspaper editor in Wilmington, who composed a response to recent presentations related to the recent presentations that were talking about the threat of black men and women, black men toward white women. And that this editorial, there was a response to the information presented in this editorial, which identified that when there were relationships between white women and black men, that often this was consensual and that the white woman initiated or was willing to a willing participant in these relationships. In other words, this was an interracial relationship that was happening, and that this was something that was not uncommon. And that was part of the construction of what was happening at that time in the effort to fight this propaganda, this big lie of Negro rule. And Dr. Crossgrove is correct in this picture that we're describing right now, which is there was a fusion of individuals from different backgrounds looking toward the common good and participating in creating the America that we should have created from the start, but that this was a threat to those in power. So, and white supremacy. This was all about white supremacy. The Democratic Party at that time in North Carolina was supporting white supremacy. And the along with that came this large amount of propaganda that was used to create what would later be called the Lost Cause, which is the big lie, which is the big lie of, you know, of then and the big lie of today with respect to January 6th. It's all connected to the same themes and ideas. So the concept of Negro rule is very similar to the concept of trying to overturn the election results in Georgia because they, you know, find one more vote than we have right now and we'll win, discussion from the previous president. That is this idea of there being control. That's the concept of Negro rule. And if you look at the numbers at a national level in, say, the late 1890s, that was dissipating, right? There weren't many elected black officials. Immediately following the Civil War, you did have elected black officials. And were there still a number of black elected officials working hand in hand with progressive whites wanting to make a difference and point this country in the right direction? Well, that was in North Carolina, and that was in Wilmington for sure. And those individuals who are working hand in hand with trying to create that reconciliation and that movement forward were the threat to white supremacy. So that's the structure when thinking about Negro rule, in my view. When I talk about Phoenix, South Carolina, Greenwood, South Carolina, where 2 days before there was a similar, smaller massacre, not a coup because the white supremacists were in power, but still yet one of the countless acts of atrocity by white supremacists against blacks in the history of this country, that the person there who was advocating for voter registration for blacks and blacks participating at the ballot box was a white man as well, trying to run a campaign to get black individuals not only power, but the ability to vote and the ability to be involved in that local governance. And that was also the reason why those individuals were the white supremacists intervened there. In fact, in Phoenix, South Carolina, there were more ballots that were cast that year than registered voters in the county, because these white supremacists had just come in to make sure that this threat would be driven out of town. In the same way, 2 days later in Wilmington, that occurred. So this, but the idea of Negro rule and the big lie, one of the big representations of the big lie at that time, was something that had been developing as we were moving further and further from any type of reconciliation. And the Democratic White Supremacist Party was wanting to defend white supremacy, as Dr. Costco said, defend that caste at all costs.
So something else that was going on during this time was the white people of Wilmington, North Carolina, came up with their own White Declaration of Independence. what do you guys think about that? And also, where do you see something similar going on today?
Well, it's important to, I think about documents like that in relationship to the violence that was occurring. That if you're somebody that is being threatened, if you're somebody that's witnessing horrific violence, are you going to do things that are going to try and take the spotlight off of you? Are you going to try and just blend in and not actually be part of a coalition or to stand up? And, you know, talking about white women are weaponized in this fight. That there's this idea that somehow black men are raping white women. But even today, when you talk about feminism, there's this trope called the white feminist that just affirms what white men want and work hand in hand to keep black women and women of color oppressed. And so you kind of have to look at people who might be, you know, out there writing documents and saying things and ask, is this what they truly think? Is this actually what was in their best interest? Or is this just somebody acting out of fear? Is this just somebody that's deciding I can't work against the system? I get a benefit from it. I'm just going to give up.
So in that white declaration, oh, go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I'll just jump in right there. And the white declaration of the Bill of Rights, right declaration of independence. It was called the Declaration of Independence, I think, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, you had those types of documents throughout history, and another type of just outward representation of white supremacy that's very similar to that. That particular document that was composed then was the when states seceded, they identified and wrote why they were seceding.
Yeah.
And those documents were very similar to the white declaration. So we see these types of documents being written over and over again, right? It kind of sounds like Dred Scott in a particular way as well, some of the language that's used. And that is continuing to this day, where we have those types of very direct representations being made. I think you just need to sit back and watch Tucker Carlson, and you will see that same type of commentary being promoted in the current moment. And I remember there was some... Rodney, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was Marjorie Taylor Greene that had some document that was being produced about what was demanded from the a lot of the insurrectionist crew, not necessarily the participants, but folks that are in the movement to overturn and to promote the big lie now and overturn the election of 2020. And there was, I think, a discussion about the word Anglo-Saxon being used in those documents, and that the media had talked about, well, you know, it's interesting that this term is being used, Anglo-Saxon. I think Colbert was joking about it. And if I'm not mistaken, some of the documents from that same time in 1898 were talking about the promotion of the Anglo-Saxon race. And that Anglo-Saxon ideas, and that the structure of the political system in the United States needed to be focused on whiteness because, and this is the longstanding inaccurate lost cause narrative, right? That after the Civil War, that everything was anarchy because blacks could not participate in effective government, that it was a bunch of corruption and failed attempts, and that whiteness needed to come in and save the day. So I think we see not only documents being composed today, including, say, even the memo that I mentioned earlier from Professor Eastman that represent that same type of thinking. And I think Dr. Krosgrove is 100% correct to talk about those documents being produced with respect to the actions that are occurring in communities and the violence on the ground and what is occurring. And that's a way in which those ideas can continue to extend beyond. You can imagine that what I think the gentleman's last name was Waddell, who was one of the perpetrators of the insurrection. You can imagine if Waddell was in the modern era, he probably would have a Twitter account and he'd be tweeting those ideas and hopefully would be banned. But, you know, you see that type of narrative today, but ultimately, at the end of the day, that is something that is just that assertion of whiteness. Now, there's a whole other discussion about the fact that, as we see in the Dred Scott case, that the actual Declaration of Independence, the actual United States Constitution before the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments was not meant to apply to non-whites. And that, what is it in Dred Scott, the line that says a white man, a black man has no rights, which the white man must respect. We see that type of conversation, that those type in Supreme Court document and Supreme Court opinions expressing those ideas. So it is something where, as we're moving away, as we the second, you know, the during the Reconstruction, when we're seeing those changes that had occurred through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, this is that pushback against that and the assertion, as Dr. Crossgrove is saying, of the dominance of the one class. So it's important. Those documents are important because sure exactly how individuals felt at that time, and they are also helpful in identifying the false narrative of the lost cause and the false narrative of the big lie. And the reason why so few people know about Wilmington or Tulsa or Rosewood or all of these other significant acts of violence on American soil, these white supremacist acts of violence, is because of this narrative, this lost cause narrative. And these documents, these primary sources, show that this is what those individuals were motivated by. This is white supremacy, that the Civil War was fought because of the protection of slavery, not because of states' rights, and so on. And it's an important piece to be aware that those documents exist and for people to be familiar with it.
So as we mentioned the White Declaration of Independence, I just wanted to give folks a feel for what was in there. So I'm going to take a minute to read a couple of things that were in this Declaration of Independence. And some of this may sound familiar to you today. And the way the article, their White Declaration of Independence starts out, believing that the Constitution of the United States contemplated a government to be carried on by an enlightened people, believing that its framers did not anticipate the enfranchisement of an ignorant population of African origin, and believing that those men of the state of North Carolina who joined in forming the Union did not contemplate for their descendants subjugation to an inferior race. That's how that White Declaration of Independence starts out. And one of the articles, it's the third article, and there are more. And I keep mentioning White Declaration of Independence because I want you all to look it up and read it for yourself. But in there, the third article in the White Declaration of Independence, it says that the Negro has demonstrated by antagonizing our interests in every way, and especially by his ballot, that he is incapable of realizing that his interests are and should be identical with those of the community, insert white community. The fifth one, that we propose in the future to give to white men at large part of the employment heretofore given to Negroes, because we realize that white families cannot thrive here unless there are more opportunities for the employment of the different members of said family. And it goes on. I just put that out there to hopefully add to the discussion. And please look up the White Declaration of Independence. Dr. Cosgrove?
So basically what you just read was a blueprint for a caste system. Who's inferior? Who has right to jobs, who has right to political power, who has right to wealth, and who does not. And it is being written whether it's written out of sincere belief or under duress because of domestic terrorism, is being written in a way to affirm we have a caste system and these people are in a certain caste and these other people are in a different caste, and that's the way it's always going to be. And we will affirm it and we will defend it. Because when you say people are naturally inferior, well, if you're inferior, you can't move out of your caste. And then we're going to make sure that you don't have access to jobs because money might be a way for you to move out of your caste. And so this declaration is a declaration of a system that is driven by white supremacy to keep people at certain levels and to keep certain people from accessing power, whether it's economic power or political power.
So what we have, and Brother Lee, Sister Rossi, I hope you did nod off over there, but I know you had read up on this a little bit.
I have so many questions. I'm really trying to be respectful of the cadence of the show. I see that we're moving forward and backward chronologically. But there's something very specific I wanted to ask, so I was trying to hold out. But I guess this is good enough time as any. Dr. Cosgrove, one of the things I saw when I was building my facts for this event in history, why? Because things happen on a why basis. I saw that during the event, one of the things they decided to do was destroy the black newspaper, destroy the ability for people to gain information about what's happening, you know, around them and in the world and in their own reality. And so what kind of propaganda do you know? What kind of propaganda? Hold on, let me fix this.
Sorry about that. So I'm asking again, because they decided to destroy the newspaper, I do believe it's, if I read it correctly, the Daily Record, they decided to destroy the press. And so what other propaganda do you know of in that area that they decided to destroy, or what other propaganda was used in order to incite this riot? Because as you said, both of you, Alex and Dr. Cosgrove, this is not an overnight affair. So I'm assuming there had to be some kind of press or some kind of convention, something used to gather this, to, you know, amalgamate this hatred and to make it take riot form.
Right. So this has to go with, like you say, access to information and education. And it's still one of the reasons that we argue so much about how poor our education system is in the United States, that people who have access to the best information have power. People who have access to reliable information have power. And that's one of the reasons right after emancipation and the beginning of Reconstruction, you see schools popping up all over the South where you've got emancipated slaves that want to learn to read and write. They want their children to learn to read and write. You're going to have the black press to make sure accurate information is getting into people's hands. And so embedded in kind of this idea of white supremacy is that some people have a right to accurate information and reliable information, and other people don't. Other people can exist and they can function in society, but you're going to make sure that their schools are not as good. You're going to make sure that they don't have independent press. You're going to have to make sure that they don't have access to each other when they're passing around information. And as much as we kind of complain about social media, one of the things that social media has done is it's democratized the ability of any one individual to get their message out, to be able to talk, to have a black Twitter, to be able to say that there's Instagram channels where I can connect with black feminists or I can connect with Native American women. That is something that's a real threat to the people who are in charge, because we can meet and we can talk and we can get reliable information into people's hands. So you're right to focus on that black newspaper being destroyed, because that was a real threat.
What were they writing? What could they have been writing? Do you have any artifacts of things that were being written or people who were writing at that time or who they were sampling that would make, I mean,
I could imagine there were quite a few places they could have destroyed, and I saw in the in the data that they did indeed do quite a bit of damage, much like Greenwood, Archer and Pine, much like they did in other places. But why? What was it about this particular area that made it so ready? Because all of North Carolina were being reflected by some of these laws. What do you think it was, Dr. Crosbow, about Wilmington itself?
Well, I'm going to go ahead and let Alex jump in.
Yes, so Dr. Crosgrove, I think, captured the temperature of the Wilmington at that time, and that this was a progressive community that had a fusion government that was unlike the majority of governments in the South, and that there were blacks and whites in leadership. Alex Manley, who is the editor of this newspaper that you've identified, is the individual who wrote the editorial that most likely was the reason why the newspaper building was burnt down. And that editorial captured the reality of interracial relationships. The editorial identified that because this was part of the big lie. In addition to Negro rule, you had people in the white supremacist Democratic Party talking about the threat posed to white women. This is the trope that Dr. Crosgrove was talking about, that black men were sexually assaulting and raping white women. And what Alex Manley wrote in the newspaper focused, and Alex Manley was a black man, he was mixed, and he was the editor of this newspaper. And after this editorial was composed, he was given 24 hours to leave Wilmington, if my memory serves me correctly. And Manley wrote that the narrative, he challenged the big lie, in other words. He wrote that the narrative that black men were sexually assaulting white women and attacking white purity was false, and that it was known that these interracial relationships were common, and that they were the choice of both the black man and the white woman, and that these were relationships that were existing, and that this was the reality and not the propaganda that black men were assaulting white women. So in a nutshell, that was what made Alex Manley and that particular newspaper a threat, in addition to what Dr. Crosgrove is talking about, which is all of the representation of the press, right? And we see this history of the black press being so important within this country and the threat that brings. Because in my work in Truth and Reconciliation and Restorative Justice, the best sources to go to are the black newspapers. When I'm working on cases in Atlanta, you've got particular newspapers that record the history and the efforts of the community better than any other representation of any other source, often because a lot of this was not documented and a lot of this was excluded from certain systems that preserved the history. Sometimes there are court records, sometimes there are other types of official records, but the newspapers are very important, and that was known, and the newspaper was also the starting point for a lot of important civil rights ideas and a way of communication pre-Twitter, any other type of news media. So this was the hub for those ideas. It gave a platform for individuals who were fighting for justice and fighting for civil rights. But
I know there were so many, so many, Mr. Alex, like that. I mean, we end up with, just the crisis, the Negro world, that idea of disseminating information. It catches our interest. That's right.
Yeah.
It catches our interest in the ability to tell our own story. And speaking of telling our own story, We do that here. We do that here at Real Radio. Real Radio, radio established to address life, and we are on at 818-691-7348. And we are open always to all commentaries, both of that of skilled, learned doctors like you, Alex, and Dr. Cosgrove, and even the what they call the grassroots voice of the person living the reality that's actually, you know, often written about by those who have the time to hover above it. And that again, that number is 7348. 818-691-7348. I want to talk about, if you would help me, please, what is the government's response to when you have mass rioting, when you have 20-something people dead, you know, when you have people injured, when you have all this going on and you say, hey, they just shot us up down here, you know, or they just dropped a bomb on us or something. You know, you go to your government and you say, listen, something is happening here. You need to do something. What should have happened? What didn't happen? What was the government's response to what is it? 11 killed blacks killed, 25 blacks wounded, and if nothing else, they would want to figure out what's up with the 3 white men that got killed, right?
As far as the federal government in this time was concerned, because again we're in kind of the tail end of the Gilded Age, the business of America was business. If it didn't impact the stock market, if it wasn't impacting your bottom line, people who were in the federal government turned a blind eye to things and said, it's not our problem. I mean, again, if you look at the 14th Amendment, it actually says if a state denies people the right to vote, they can lose representation in Congress. But nobody ever implemented it. Nobody ever took that tool that is still sitting there and used it. They could use it today. It's in the 14th Amendment. But they refused to do so because we have to have some votes on a bill, or we've got some type of economic deal that's happening, or it might cause problems on the stock market. And so the federal government has not been very good at all at making sure that they are actually living up to equal protection of the laws.
So if
there'll be no army coming in, there'll be no increased police presence, there'll be no, something should happen when you have a population, when you have a portion of the population turn on another, you know, a large number turn on another smaller portion of the population. There should be something.
Yes, and I think that if my memory serves me correctly, that the lone black congressman, I believe Congressman White at the time, went all the way to President McKinley, and President McKinley didn't take action, or even I don't think there's even a record of a comment of his perspective on the issue. And keep in mind, and this is where Dr. Cosgrove's commentary really comes into play as well in thinking about the structure in the Republican Party, because McKinley was a Republican, right? And here you go having the individuals who are we've got a coup going on, and McKinley's perspective would be important here, and he made no effort to intervene, even though this was the party that was supposed to be on the side of justice and against white supremacy. So very, very disappointing. McKinley was later assassinated and in 1901. And the bottom line is, though, the response didn't come from the federal government. The response also didn't come from the local government because the Klan essentially controlled those types of law enforcement responses. And we see that to this day, right, Rodney? I think it was about a year and a half ago that we had that hot mic issue with those law enforcement officers in Wilmington, North Carolina, of all places, talking about very aggressive ideas of whiteness and racism. So you see that there's often a difficult effort to get justice in all of these, and that's really the effort that we, now that we're at this point in history, need to take a look at finding ways of bringing justice and this so many years later. It not only was something that we couldn't find justice for, but for decades people wouldn't talk about it. And when people did talk about it, it was always from the perspective that it was an aggressive group of radical white and blacks who were fighting against the community, that this was a riot caused by armed black insurrectionists. Where do we see that disconnect again with what really happened and the narrative that's being presented? Well, of course, on January 6th, right?
January 6th.
It was Antifa, or it was people dressed up as Democrats. Antifa dressed up as and so on. The same narrative existed post Wilmington, and it was decades that we had this incorrect idea because of the lost cause, because of the big lie that there were that it was a different cause for the insurrection. Yeah, you know, that's the same thing going on now, where it's Black Lives Matter is the aggressor. Black Lives Matter is responsible for this act of violence. Oh, you think January 6th is bad? Well, look at what they did in Oregon. You know, those types of very just outright false narratives that were occurring. That was happening then, right? And we saw that too with the history of Tulsa. That's the whole story of Reconstruction, right? That black folks cannot be in control of government, and there's violence and there's fraud and there's corruption, when really it's violence and fraud and corruption of the KKK at that particular time. So that's one of the problems with, I think that's such an important point, is how do we move forward with these concepts when we know that so much of what that history is, has been presented, is false. You see that that narrative being presented. That's what Woodrow Wilson showed in the White House, right? One of the most racist of the commander in chief, the birth of a nation, right? And those, that history of presenting, and that fits in with the interracial relationships too. If you watch the film and you see those racist white supremacist tropes, and then this courageous effort of defending the South, that the fight was noble for the Civil War, that it wasn't about slavery, it was about other things like states' rights, and that the cause is worth recognizing and remembering and acknowledging and promoting and honoring. And that's why you see right around this time, around the same time as Wilmington and shortly thereafter, all of these monuments being put up to the Confederate leaders, to Lee, to Davis, to everybody in between, to Bedford Forrest, all these individuals. Those monuments were not built immediately after the Civil War. Those monuments were built when you had the creation of a historical narrative called the Lost Cause, and that was going on at this particular time as well. And I'll step back and let Dr. Crossgrove jump in.
Before Dr. Crossgrove jumps in, give me a second, Alex, because you hit on something that's important. And Dr. Crossgrove, you can jump in after I do my piece. You said reconciliation or healing the past. Do either of you think that we'll ever get to a point where reparations are a true discussion in America, or have we gone too far down the rabbit hole that we'll never come out of it because it would take more gumption, to be quite honest with you, than most of us have?
Dr. Crosco?
But I think that was, yeah, I think it depends on how you define reparations, because I work at a community college, and we've been fighting for a long time to make community college free. It's access to the tools you need to be an entrepreneur, to get a better job, to have economic independence. And we're treated like, you know, we're giving away the Taj Mahal. It's an associate's degree. It's a certificate. It's an apprenticeship. And so I think there's a lot of things that they tried to put in that Build Back Better bill that would have started to address some of these inequities. And notice this, that stuff got pulled out, that's what was targeted and pulled out of that bill. So I would like to just see, empower people so that they can build their own wealth, give them access to free college, make sure they have small business loans, make sure they have mentors that they can work with. But even those things, we get radical pushback against.
Yes, so true. And it's incredibly unfortunate that we have programs or ideas that are viewed as threats, right, as handouts, when this is the exact opposite. This is creating society. This is what the whole idea of community and governments is about. And that's where we have that the horrible presence that exists right now in one of the political parties that just is against anything going to anyone that is not like that. And you've identified that, Dr. Koskov, so well about this caste system that exists. And anything that can go to promote the success of another, particularly a person of color, is found to be extremely objectionable and going against this whole white supremacist structure in this country. On the topic of reparations, I feel that reparations is one of the most important, if not the most important, step toward reconciliation. We have H.R. 40 that has been introduced for since, 1990 by Congressman Conyers. I'm from Michigan. And now I believe it's Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas. I think that reparations are possible and reparations are essential. Reparations have worked in this country. There are concrete examples of past harms and using judicial remedies in the form of reparations to address those past harms. Until we're able to...
Including those racial slave owners. We gave them their reparations, right? When at the end of the Civil War, we paid those for the missing wages and whatnot. I just want you all to know that this is the issue is going to be with information. Every time we talk about it, every time you speak on it, you surprise somebody. You teach, every time you say the words Wilmington, North Carolina, first of all, we have to give Lita understand we're not talking about Wilmington, Delaware. You're going to do
Delaware.
That?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Then after you get through getting them oriented geographically, they're going to clutch their imaginary pearls and say, what? They did what? And it happens time and time and time again. And so the issue is, are we all willing to become one of those people? What are those people, Mr. Gushy? One of those people are the ones who can't have small banter anymore. Every time you talk to them, you end up coming to where you need your folded, you need your little booklet, where you keep just keeping tally of all the facts and information that person has to offer. Because until we all convert over to being one of those people, everybody gets to say, what happened? When? To who? What? And it just happens over and over again. You have to talk about it every day until you die in order for us to be ready to repair what happened, because you're still informing people, you know, 200 years later, dang near, that it happened.
I couldn't agree more. And the topic of reparations is one of those topics that falls into that category, right, where we need to have those critical conversations, and we need to think about ways in which we can be not only creative but also courageous in finding those restorative justice remedies. And we have the template in place for this discussion right now, and I think that from my perspective, as a participant in restorative justice efforts, that these reparations need to be direct and they need to be in the form of cash payments to African descent slaves who, or as we've seen from Coates' essays afterward, that there's a broad range of types of ways in which reparations can be applied because of the harm that has extended until the current day, including redlining, Jim Crow laws, convict leasing, all of these other structures that also restorative justice remedies are needed. And if reparations can apply to others in American history, then this is the main issue for looking at the movement forward for reconciliation that you had mentioned before. My family is the direct benefit of has directly benefited from cash reparations. On my mother's side, my family during World War II was incarcerated, was placed in concentration camps by the United States government. My grandmother was in Manzanar. My grandfather was in Gila River. My aunts and some of my grandmother's cousins were over in Idaho and Minnesota. And there were reparations through the Civil Liberties Act of 1998 that were granted Japanese Americans who were placed in unjustly during World War II in outdoor prisons, right? And that is the model that there is success. Cash payments,
right,
reparations for past harms.
If we want to teach
possible.
It. And I want to thank you both. I want to thank you, Dr. Cosgrove, for coming again. Every time you come, you further our understanding of what it means to be, for the good, the bad, and the ugly, of what it means to be an American. What is the narrative? What is the story? And I can imagine it took quite a bit of research in order for you to be able to tell a hidden narrative. Because it's one thing to tell the story that everybody wants to hear. It's another to have to dig like you're a truffle farmer for these little tidbits of information that you can then piece together piecewise, you know, to build a historical narrative. Thank you both so much for my history lesson today, some of which I knew, some of which, again, like I said, they did what, who, when, what. Thank you so much for slowly becoming those people, you know what I'm saying, being one of those people. Mr. Rodney, thank you again. You lined up fantastic guests for us today. The information we got today, we can take straight to, well, we don't go to encyclopedias no more, as Mr. Rodney explained. We all go to Google. And if someone wanted to become more understanding, you know, more cognitive of this era and what was happening, they would put things like Wilmington, North Carolina, Lee. They would put numbers like 1870 is where they might want to start?
It would be like right after the Civil War ended. So 1865
right
is about 1870.
To get the temperature of what was happening, not just nationally, but then also more locally there in North Carolina, as it was right there as part of the colonies, right? Part of that heated part where they really felt like they had a stake in what this country was because they were there, you know, from the inception, right? So
exactly.
North Carolina, they would want to put in 1865 to 1890, something like that, if you want to get it done in a time-lapse portion. Some names that we should be looking up are definitely McKinley Johnson, Abraham, you know, who were some more prominent names there in North Carolina?
Alex Manley.
Alex,
sure.
Do you know names?
Yeah, Alex Manley is definitely
sure.
Worth looking at. The severe and the bad guy here is a variety of different people, but Alfred Waddell, I believe, is the name of the perpetrator who had moved forward with the effort to execute the insurrection. There's a Reverend Charles Morris who gave a terrific eyewitness account, and this eyewitness account is in a text that I strongly encourage, and I know that listeners to this program have probably heard it quoted many times, Before the Mayflower, A History of Black America by Lorraine Bennett Jr. And that text has some direct commentary about, it's a short passage, but still a passage nonetheless about what occurred, a direct account of what occurred on November 10th. Also, thinking about because I think Wilmington should be thought about along with the Greenwood, South Carolina massacre as well, the 2 days before, Benjamin Mays, the great civil rights activist, he was there and he observed the atrocity. He was 5 years old. So that's another name of somebody to look at during that time. Of course, if we look at the immediate situation within the public consciousness of the black community at that time, 2 years before, we had the Atlanta Compromise from Booker T. Washington, and you had folks who were presenting an alternative narrative, W.E.B. Du Bois and folks in the Niagara Movement and so forth that came or were coming into development there. So from big picture context, that's also worth looking into. So those are some places to begin as we look into the ways of continuing to review. And also, and I know we're short on time, but I do really encourage folks to take a look at the 1898 Wilmington Race Riot Commission. That's what it's called, the commission. And there's a 500-page report that goes in depth, in detail, related to what happened on November 10th, 1898.
I want to slide another one in there. Charles Brantley Aycott, he became governor of North Carolina, and he authored a speech here in Baltimore called The Negro Problem, which he gave in December of 1903. On the 18th of December 1903, he gave that speech here in Baltimore, The Negro Problem. He eventually became the governor of the state of North Carolina. So definitely look into him and his dealings with the whole ordeal in Wilmington, North Carolina, without a doubt. Look, family, I thank you all for coming on today. Again, I missed the first go around, but I'm so glad I was here to catch the second go around. Rodney, thank you for finding such esteemed and great guests. I thank both of you, Dr. Cosgrove and Alex, for your time this morning. I know it's very early on your side of the world, so I appreciate you getting up. Hopefully you had your Folgers in your cup this morning, or a little gin in your tea. I don't know which one you take, but either one, you know, usually works for me. But honestly, thank you both for your time, and we appreciate you.
Well, thank you for having us on. And if there's one person I can plug for today, it's Reverend Dr. Barber.
Yes, ma'am.
Because Wilmington was targeted because white people and black people found common cause and worked together. That was a threat.
Right.
That needs to be something we're doing more of today.
Right. Rodney and I actually had the pleasure of meeting and interviewing Reverend Barber when he was in Vegas for the NAACP convention. So that was an awesome thing. Alex, you have any plugs before we go?
Well, I definitely plug Reverend Barber as well, for sure, when it comes to – because that is North Carolina – you know, he is from North Carolina, and that is the ongoing theme to his activism in North Carolina as well. So I definitely endorse Reverend Barber's as being the current-day representation of that fusion effort.
Well, let's not forget that Rodney Smith is also from North Carolina. You know, he might live in Vegas now, but his heart is always in supply. Look, family, thank you all for listening live and listening later. We appreciate you. We look forward to bringing you another hot one next week. And until then, you all be good, be safe, and we love you, and a damn thing you can do about it.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Dr. Cross.